Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Wisconsin Supreme Court is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Annette Kingsland Ziegler presiding. Your silence is commanded.
All right. Good morning. Go ahead and have a seat. And we are here for the first case, Secura Supreme Insurance Company versus the estate of Daniel Keith Huck, 20 AP 1078 FT. Could I please have your appearances? All right, good morning. All right, good morning to both of you as well. I have 25 minutes, followed by 20 minutes, 10 minutes, and then 5 minutes on rebuttal, correct? Okay. Now that we have that set, let's proceed. Mr. Silver?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Patrick Silver, and I represent Secura Supreme Insurance Company. Today we're here to determine the amount required to be paid by Secura Supreme under an uninsured motorist provision in a policy that was issued to Mr. Huck. Mr. Huck tragically died in an automobile accident during the course and scope of his employment. He applied for workers' compensation benefits and received $35,000 and change. And I'm going to be using round numbers to keep the arithmetic easy. The Huck estate then instituted a proceeding under WSSTAT section 10229 in order to pursue a recovery against the tortfeasor that caused the injury that resulted in the death of Mr. Huck. Now, the tortfeasor carried $25,000 in liability limits. Secura issued a policy to Mr. Huck that had $250,000 in underinsured motorist coverage. In the 10229 proceeding, Mr. Huck, or his estate, sought a recovery that resulted in the following. First of all, there was a settlement for the full $25,000 that was available to the tortfeasor to cover that person's liability. Now, there's a formula under 10229 that determines how the judgment or settlement is distributed. There is a cost of recovery element which is taken off the top. Thereafter, the remaining number is divided into thirds. The first third goes to the claimant, that would be the Huck estate. Thereafter, any amounts paid out to the worker or by the worker comp carrier would be available to satisfy their payout. And then anything left over would be available to the claimant. Now, in this case, what happened is that the $25,000 resulted in roughly, and again, I'm going to be using approximate numbers to keep the arithmetic easy, roughly $10,000 that went to the Huck estate as the cost of recovery. So we can think of that as the number that goes to the representatives or attorneys in order to pursue the 10229 recovery. Now that left approximately $15,000 out of the 25. If you divide that by three, you get 5,000, 5,000, and 5,000. The first 5,000 went to the Huck estate. So now the Huck estate has the 10,000 in the cost of recovery and the 5,000 as the first third. They've got 15,000 in their 10229 recovery. Thereafter, the remainder went to the worker comp carrier or employer that paid out the worker comp benefits. Now, because the benefits were $35,000, there was only $10,000 left, and all of that went to the carrier slash employer. There was nothing left over afterwards to go to the Huck estate. So in the 102-29 proceeding, the Huck estate wound up with roughly $15,000. That amount was added to the $35,000 that they recovered as worker compensation benefits, resulting in $50,000. Now, here's the sticking point. The estate made a UIM claim with Secura. Under Secura's policy, Secura is permitted to reduce both the liability coverage that's paid by the tortfeasor as well as any amount paid or payable under workers' compensation law.
Counsel, do you agree that that claim does not accrue until there is final resolution of the underlying cause of action by the injured party against the tortfeasor?
Your Honor, if I understand the question correctly, until there is such time as there is resolution of the 102-29 claim, I believe the estate argues that the amount payable by Secura cannot be determined. However, here, the estate was paid their $35,000 in workers' compensation. But if I may, I don't think that the answer to the question matters.
Okay, that's what I want to hear from you. But the first part of my question is, do you agree that the cause of action accrues consistent with 893.43(2), which says a cause of action involving the underinsured motorist coverage accrues on the date there is final resolution of the underlying cause of action by the injured party against the tortfeasor?
I see.
Think you probably agree with that since I read it verbatim from the statute.
I agree, but that begs the question as to when the resolution occurred as to the underlying tort action. And in this instance, I think it could be argued that that was at the time of the settlement pursuant to the 102-29, Chapter 102 proceeding. In other words, I don't think there was a separate complaint filed in the circuit court respecting the amount that the victim would seek from the third-party tortfeasor. I don't think. Can't recall whether that's even in the record. But what we do know is that any right that the Huck estate would have as against the tortfeasor would be pursuant to 102-29. So if the amount payable by depends on resolution of that 102-29 proceeding, then I think it could fairly be said that the cause of action by the Huck estate as to Secura would accrue only when there is some finality as to the 102-29 proceeding.
So at that point in time, how much had the estate received from workers' comp?
The estate had received $35,000.
At the point in time at which, how much was actually in the pockets of the estate at the time at which the 102 proceeding was resolved?
It's my understanding that the $35,000 was in their pocket.
And you don't think that the fact that they had to pay back $9,000, let's say approximately $10,000 of that, I'm asking how much they actually got from workers' comp. How much did they get from workers' comp? At the end of the day, how much did they get?
Well, I mean, Your Honor, I'm trying to answer that question. The record shows that the worker comp paid $35,000 and change.
And the record shows that $10,000 of it, they stood in the place of the estate and recovered and took basically $10,000 back from the estate.
I agree.
Okay. So how much at the end of the day? So let me put it this way. How about this example? I go to buy a sandwich at lunch. I hand over $20. The sandwich is $8. I get $12 back in change, and I can claim my $8 sandwich for reimbursement for work, right?
Correct.
How much did I pay?
You paid $8 for the sandwich.
So I paid $8, but I got right. $12, but I paid 20, right? I handed over 20.
Correct.
But I paid 8.
Correct.
So do you understand where I'm going here?
I do. And I don't want, I mean, it's a fair question. I don't want to take too much time getting in the weeds on that issue because that goes to the question of whether there's an obligation that's satisfied and so on. And frankly, I don't think that that really ultimately matters here. And the reason why is because at the end of the day, we have to remember what the purpose of underinsured motorist coverage is, which is to basically stand in the place of the amount of liability coverage that the tortfeasor would have had it not been for the decision of not purchasing enough or any insurance. In other words, think about it this way. Suppose that the tortfeasor in this case, in fact, had $250,000 in liability insurance. If that were the case, it would turn out that the tortfeasor would end up paying a given amount under the 10229 proceeding, and on top of the amount that the estate would recover as worker comp benefits, the estate would ultimately recover in this case around $230,000. Now, I can walk you through the arithmetic. This is in our brief in chief, but it's fairly straightforward. In a proceeding under 10229, if there were $250,000 available as liability insurance, remember, the first that comes off is the cost of recovery. Now, here we can assume, without deciding, that it was roughly one-third, because that's typically what a representative of the claimant would charge. It doesn't matter, because that ultimately inures to the benefit of the claimant. It's up to the claimant to make the decision as to how much they're going to pay their attorney. But at the end of the day, assuming it's one-third amount, what we have is $250,000. That's the settlement. We subtract one-third of that. It'll leave around $160,000. Again, I'm sort of making the numbers easy. So now you've got $160,000 to work with. Remember, after that, you basically divide it into thirds. The first third goes to the claimant. Now, that's about $53,000. So you add the $53,000 to the $90,000 that goes as the cost of recovery, and that leaves about $107,000. Now, after that $107,000, the worker comp carrier or employer gets their money out of the liability insurance settlement that's left, either if in total or it will leave a residue. Now here, this is an important fact. The insurer under a $250,000 liability policy would have gotten the full $35,000 back that they paid in workers' comp, and they would have gotten back the $20,000 that they paid into the workers' compensation fund. So that would have stripped another $55,000 out of the full amount that would have been available. That would have left $53,000. And if you add up the $53,000 that's left over that goes to the claimant, you include the $53,000 that they got after the cost of recovery, and you add the cost of recovery, it will give you $230,000. Why is that important? It's important because whether you accept the estate's net benefit approach or if you accept Secura Supreme's gross benefit approach, in both cases, the UIM recovery is greater than what the estate would have recovered had the tortfeasor possessed the full $250,000 in liability coverage. And that produces an anomalous result. The purpose of UIM and UM insurance is to effectively provide the tortfeasor with the amount of coverage that they would have had but for the foresight of insuring for a higher limit.
So here, putting aside your hypothetical, In the case we have in front of us, they bargained for the $250,000 to be put in the place of, yet under your reasoning, they do not get $250,000 because they had to pay $10,000 back to the workers' comp carrier, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So here we would leave someone who bargained $250,000. That's their bargain. That's their contract. Yet they would only be getting $240,000.
Under the facts, that's the result that follows from the plain language.
Well, that's the result that follows from your reasoning. I don't know. When we talk about plain language, the word is paid. That's about the only plain language I can see. And as I asked about my example, I don't know. I mean, you're saying it's paid at the time that you hand over the $20 bill for the sandwich, that's $20 that was paid. That's your reasoning, right?
My reasoning is that you begin with the plain language of the statute. It talks about the amount that's paid. The worker comp amount that was paid was $35,000. That's subtracted from the UIM limit. And then what is further subtracted is the amount that's paid by liability insurance, and that here that was $25,000. The sticking point is whether the amount that is called upon to reimburse the insurer for $10,000 is something that should fall within the requirements under the insurance policy. But my point is that in either event, the insured winds up, that is, the estate winds up, in a better position than they would have had the tortfeasor simply had $250,000 in liability coverage. And the reason this is important is because we look to the plain language in the statute and the policy which incorporates the statute. The Tischendorf case resulted in a split court on the issue of whether the statutory language and the policy language at issue was either ambiguous or absurd. Both read the language in the statute as plain. However, the so-called absurd faction determined that even though the language was plain, applying the plain language to the circumstances in that case produced an absurd result. But that's because in that case, the UM limit was being reduced by the $20,000 that was paid to the Supplemental Workers' Compensation Fund. That is not at issue in this case. And so here, if you look at the plain language and ask the question, is the result absurd, that is, the result Secura Supreme is insisting on, the answer is no. And the reason it's not absurd is because at the end of the day, the victim actually ends up with more than they would have ended up with had the tortfeasor simply possessed $250,000 in liability limits. No questions. That's refreshing. So let me basically sum up the principal point here. What we're faced with is, in the final analysis, a question of statutory interpretation. It cannot be said that the statutory language is construed against Secura Supreme, because this is not contract language, and so the doctrine that construes a contract against the drafter is not at issue. This is language which is the function of and result of the Wisconsin legislature. And while there are ways of determining legislative language to be ambiguous, it is not something that is construed against an insurance company if that language is incorporated into an insurance policy. So we can set aside the issue of whether the language should be construed against Secura Supreme. We're left with language that the Supreme Court has previously struggled over, with three justices concluding that the language was plain but ambiguous.
Isn't the $10,000 you're talking about the same $10,000 that the estate already paid
back to the UC carrier?
The $10,000 is taken out of the $25,000
settlement. That wasn't my
settlement.
Question. My question was, isn't it the same $10,000? It was $9,700 or whatever. I'm using your number. Isn't it the same $10,000 that the estate already paid back to the UC carrier? Isn't that what you're now subtracting from the $250,000 of underinsured motorist coverage? Isn't it the same $10,000? If it's not, where'd you get the number?
The $10,000 was paid back by the estate to the worker comp carrier. The $10,000.
Isn't that the $10,000 you're also subtracting from the $250,000 of UIM coverage?
The $10,000 is a part of the $25,000 liability limit.
I know what it's a part of. That wasn't my question. My question was, isn't it the same $10,000 that you're now subtracting from the $250,000 of UIM coverage?
Your Honor, respectfully, I don't think that it is the same.
Okay, where'd you get the number then?
Well, the number...
Why is it exactly the same, $9,700 and change?
Well, the numbers are the same. The numbers as a figure on a piece of paper are the same, but the sources of the numbers are not the same. The 10,000 that...
Under your reasoning, then, the estate should pay twice. They should have paid back what the statute required to give to the UC carrier and or the workers' compensation carrier. That's who paid out the money. And now you think it should be deducted from the $250,000 of UIM first-party coverage that the deceased bought, right?
That's what the language in the statute provides. That's the plain language of the statute. It allows the insurer to reduce the liability limit, and it allows the insurer to reduce the amounts paid.
Counsel, if suppose there had been a mathematical error and more was paid out that way, would your position be the same?
If, for example, somebody forgot to carry the one.
Sure. Yeah.
I would think that that would be something that would be remedied by some post-settlement resolution, reforming an agreement or something to that effect. But that would be simply a matter of a confirmed amount owed but a miscalculation.
I want to hear your response to, and Justice Dallet asked this question, and I just want to follow up again and give you another opportunity to respond to it. But one argument here is you have a $250,000 policy. That's what the insured purchased. And so what we're doing is we're writing a contract. Granted, the contract incorporates some statutory language, but it's a contract. We read contracts as a whole. Why isn't the most reasonable reading of this disputed language one that ensures a $250,000 recovery consistent with the declarations and consistent with the overall contractual language ensuring a $250,000 recovery? It strikes me potentially, at least an argument is, that your position makes this sort of back and forth with workers' comp kind of a unique one-off that leads the insured to recover less than the amount that was purchased. I'd love to hear your response to that argument.
My response is that the facts control how much the insured recovers. And in this instance, the facts result in a recovery based on the plain language that subtracts or reduces the limit by the amounts paid by workers' compensation and the amount paid by the liability carrier, which is $25,000. The fact that $10,000 of that $25,000 is effectively paid by the insured back to the worker comp carrier is it's not relevant because the plain language says what it says, and it's our position that if the legislator wished for the language to be more precise on this question, then it would have said so, and that it's ultimately the best decision to allow the plain language to stand. And if the citizens of the state of Wisconsin desire for a different result, then it's up to the legislature to effectuate that will.
Yeah, just to follow up real quickly, it's a little bit of begging the question. What I'm saying is that suppose this language can be read different ways, and the court in the past has struggled with how to read it. One of the ways we resolve questions about, you know, a statute's meaning or contract's meaning is by looking to other contractual language. The other contractual language here is you've got a $250,000 policy that was purchased by the insured. Why wouldn't that be one of the things we would consider when reading this language?
Thank you, Your Honor. That's a good question. You read the policy as a whole, and so you can't simply look at the $250,000 limit that's on the coverages on the declarations page without seeking to make sense of what that means in the context of the rest of the policy. And the policy specifically sets forth this reducing clause, which effectively mirrors the language in 632.32. And even if it didn't, 632.32 is built into and incorporated by operation of law into the policy, so it's as if the statute was a declaration form. Therefore, you have to read the available $250,000 limit in the context of other parts of the policy, and then ultimately, necessarily, depending on whatever the facts are. And here the facts are that the worker comp carrier paid $35,000. That was received by the estate, and the liability carrier paid $25,000. Both of those amounts are subtracted from the UIM limit, resulting in the $190,000 that was paid by Secura.
The result in Teschendorf seemed to have been driven by the fact that the court decided that, well, it just can't be. This is not fair. This is anomalous. To what extent should we consider the fact that had the negligent driver in this situation had higher limits, the estate, Huck's estate, would have received even less? Should we be so focused on the outcome or the results of particular calculations under different facts, or should we simply apply the contract language?
I think I hear two questions. Unfortunately, my light is red, and I'm not allowed
to answer.
I may. Thank you, Your Honor. I think that ultimately, you have to have a uniform principle of applying the law to whatever the contract says. And so if it turned out that the liability limit was, I believe, less than $25,000, then you would simply apply the law to whatever that result would produce under the circumstances. I'm not going to go through the exercise. If the liability limits were more, then you would do the same thing. But I don't think that the appropriate result would be to sort of change how the law applies fact to fact. I think that a bright line rule is the best approach.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. John.
Good morning, Justices. May it please the Court. The appellate court's decision in this case should be affirmed to prevent insurers from reaping the benefit of a windfall double offset from an injured worker's UIM recovery that insureds like my client purchased and relied upon to be made whole. To that end, I'd like to make 3 points. One, pursuant to Teschendorf, the plain language of 632.32.5(i)(2) does not allow UIM offset of reimbursed amounts. Two, the Court of Appeals decision in this case provides for a predetermined fixed level of coverage that the insured paid for and contracted for. And three, it runs no risk of double recovery. To my first point, starting with the plain language of the statute, 632.32.5(i)(2) does not say amounts paid or payable by the workers' comp insurer. It says amounts paid or payable under any workers' compensation law. Under any workers' compensation law is referring to Chapter 102 as a whole. And under Wisconsin workers' comp law, which is the law that applies in this case and is what the reducing clause refers us to, any payment from a work comp insurer under that chapter is always contingent upon reimbursement under 102.29. Chapter 102 specifically states, cautions people that a settlement of a third-party claim is void unless the settlement and the distribution of the proceeds of the settlement from the tortfeasor go through this reimbursement formula that we've talked about, and that that settlement and the formula is approved by a judge or ALJ. Because the reducing clause's language, paid under any workers' comp law, refers to the work comp chapter as a whole, which includes this mandatory reimbursement before you make your UIM claim, that phrase should be interpreted as unambiguously referring to the amount of workers' comp paid after the reimbursement. Moreover, the court in Teschendorf analyzed 632.32.5(i)(2) and held that the statute only authorizes reductions in limits by the amounts paid to the insured. The Court of Appeals in this case held that the statutory analysis set forth in Teschendorf guides the decision in this case, and that the analysis actually applied with equal, if not more, force in a case like this. The Court of Appeals correctly pointed out that nothing in 632.32.5(i)(2) restricts the reducing clause's application to some certain or specific period of time. Nothing in the statute suggests that the provision is limited to the initial payment before reimbursement. And the Court of Appeals felt that it was even clearer or more compelling in this case than in Teschendorf, because in Teschendorf, the insurer actually paid into the fund without any reimbursement, where in our case, the Court of Appeals explained that the financial impact of this disputed amount, the 97-1873 or the 10 grand, however we want to refer to it, the financial impact to both the estate and the work comp carrier was zero. And so the Court of Appeals held that the estate was not paid the 97-1873 at issue because of the legislatively mandated requirement to reimburse the work comp carrier. The Court of Appeals rejected Secura's argument that Huck was paid this amount by simply ignoring the reimbursement as defying common sense, because it's just not the math. As Your Honor pointed out, when Mr. Huck presented his UIM claim to Secura, he had received $51,000 in total from the tortfeasor and the work comp carrier, not $60,000. It's why Secura's chart on page 30 of its brief shows that Huck has shortchanged exactly the disputed amount of 97-1873 off of his 250,000 UIM limits if you accept Secura's reading of the reducing clause. It's because Huck didn't actually receive that disputed amount. The Court of Appeals also correctly noted that if you'd rather analyze it from the context of the work comp carrier, they didn't pay the 97-1873 either. There is no way the insurer, the work comp insurer in this case, in say its year-end taxes, would argue that it paid the $35,000 without accounting for its reimbursement. So whether you analyze it from Huck's perspective or the work comp carrier's perspective, the Court of Appeals properly held that the estate was not paid that amount at issue. This court has made clear in the Bray and Teschendorf decisions, for example, that ascertaining plain meaning of a statute requires more than focusing on a single sentence or a portion of it. The statute's context and the structure of it are critical to a plain meaning analysis. The plain meaning approach to statutory interpretation is not literalistic. The meaning of words need to be placed in context and with a view to their place in the overall statutory scheme.
But the court in Teschendorf didn't apply plain meaning because three members of the court found the language ambiguous. Three members of the court deemed the language or the result, not the language, to be absurd. So actually, if they had applied the plain meaning, they just didn't like the result, so they called it absurd. And then one member of the court concurred but didn't join either of what have been deemed factions. So you're stressing plain meaning, but the Teschendorf court did not find the language plain at all.
Sure. I understand that the court took some different tracks to get to the ultimate ruling in Teschendorf, that the reading of the statute only permitted the amounts only permitted the UIM carrier to reduce by amounts the person actually received. I agree with you that the Court of Appeals in this case focused on that part of the ruling, but I would certainly say that the Bray decision explains to us that this court has rejected the type of hyper-literal reading of the reducing clause that Sakura is advocating for in this case.
But there is a difference between applying plain meaning and an overly literalist of language, isn't that right?
I agree with that. I think, though, that the court, in applying a plain meaning statute, can look to the context of the statute. It can look at the overall statutory scheme. And when you look at the plain language of 632.32.5(i)(2) in this case, it specifically says amounts paid under workers' compensation law. I think the plain meaning reading of that is it's referring to Chapter 102 as a whole, in its entirety, a chapter that has a legislatively mandated reimbursement formula that needs to be finalized before you can present your UIM claim. I think that's what the Court of Appeals in this case did. They looked at the context of the overall statutory scheme, including in conjunction with Chapter 102 and that mandatory reimbursement requirement, and correctly rejected Sakura's reading of the reducing clause. Sakura's brief also recognizes that the purpose of the statute can also be part of the plain meaning analysis, and this court has repeatedly noted that the purpose of UIM coverage is to protect insureds injured in accidents, to make them whole. Sakura's attempt to benefit from this double offset is directly contrary to that purpose. If there are two reasonable ways to read Sakura's reducing clause, then it is ambiguous and must be construed in Huck's favor as well. This court has explained that reducing clauses that mirror 632.32.5(i) can be contextually ambiguous. Tracking the language of the statute doesn't mean a word or phrase is unambiguous in every context, because words cannot anticipate every possible fact situation. This court has said that a statute can be unambiguous in one context but ambiguous in another. Again, in Teschendorf, some of the justices found the word paid to be ambiguous. Even when there was no dispute, the work comp insurer paid into the fund without any reimbursement, because those justices said one would be inclined to believe that there is an implicit condition that the insurer only be permitted to reduce UM benefits by payments made to or on behalf of the insured. Again, the focus being on what the insured actually receives.
Counsel, you're raising multiple alternative arguments, and that's great. I understand why you do that in light of this case. And that I just want to hear from you what you think your strongest argument or simplest straightforward argument is in your favor among the multiple arguments that you raise. And it sounded like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that maybe you think that the simplest way is simply that the contract refers to the workers' compensation law generically, which refers to the whole workers' compensation law, which includes the reimbursement scheme, ergo then you win. And you would need to get to ambiguity or other sorts of things if, in fact, this court concluded you were correct on that interpretive analysis. Is that your first argument, or do you or is there another argument that you think is your strongest, most straightforward way?
I think Your Honor is correct. I think the plain language of 632.32.5(i)(2) referring to paid under any workers' compensation law unambiguously includes the reimbursement under Chapter 102.29. Courts in other jurisdictions, if this court did find it, if there was an argument that it was ambiguous, courts in other jurisdictions have found similar language ambiguous. The Cherry and the Wildman cases we cited talk about reasonable people reading this differently. So did the Court of Appeals in the Harlow versus Allstate case, the Oregon Court of Appeals. But a cite from that I think is important. The Oregon court, analyzing similar language to 632.32.5(i)(2), said that both of the interpretations, the same ones that are being applied here, are textually permissible, but held that the context supports plaintiff's interpretation because the purpose of Oregon's UIM statute was to prevent double recovery, not to provide the insured with anything less than the full recovery up to the UIM policy limits. And the Court of Appeals in Oregon said that one interpretation achieves that purpose and the other one defeats it.
Counsel, I want to follow up on one of the other arguments that's made here is referenced while you're opposing counsel, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. In many ways, it's a sort of an alternative ground, but goes to a question I think that Justice Ann Walsh Bradley asked regarding when accrual happens here, which is a different argument, not so much focused on the language that you identified, but more broadly the statute of when the settlement with the tortfeasor has occurred. Do you, in that argument's made in the, one of the amicus briefs, do you agree with that argument? Is that an alternative ground? And I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Yes, I agree. I think it's important to look at when your UIM case accrues. That's the point with the plain language of 632.32.5(i)(2), and the point I made earlier that the settlement with the tortfeasor can't even be approved. You can't present your UIM claim until the underlying case is finalized. And part of that finalizing of the case with the tortfeasor is that you follow the statutorily required reimbursement under 10229. And not only that you follow it, that be approved and signed off on by an ALJ or a judge. And so that's the point, is when you are done with your underlying settlement, it has gone through that process before you present your UIM claim. And so if you look at the amounts received by Huck at the time he presents his UIM claim, it's the $51,000 that we're arguing, not the $60,000 that Secura is arguing.
Would you please slow that down for me a little bit? So that the statute says on the underlying cause of action by the injured party against the tortfeasor, the final resolution of that. Could you just sort of walk through for me logically, it's why you have to wait for all of that, and that constitutes, under the meaning of this statute, a final resolution against the tortfeasor?
Sure. Person is injured in the course and scope of their employment. They have probably going on simultaneously a workers' comp claim, then they make their claim against the tortfeasor. When you settle your claim with the tortfeasor, you take the funds and literally fill out a third-party distribution form. It's a state-mandated formula. You plug in the numbers. I won't go through them. Attorney Silver went through them in this case. You plug those in. You figure out what the estate's going to get. There's cost of collections, and then included in that formula is the amount that the work comp carrier is going to get reimbursed. Arguably, under Chapter 102, work comp carriers have an independent right of action. They could pursue it on their own. But in the most cases, you would settle it, you run it through that formula, you now know what needs to be reimbursed to the work comp carrier. You then take that formula, it's approved by an ALJ or a judge, and then at that point, after that, you make your UIM claim.
Let me just follow up then, because it sounds like from what you said, it's not always the case, or it's not necessarily the case, that the reimbursements with workers' comp would always be dealt with in a final resolution with the tortfeasor. The reason that matters is because, you know, one of the arguments being advanced is that we ought to just settle it on that ground, that something is accrues at a particular point in time. But if that doesn't actually answer the question here, or maybe it does here, but maybe it does or doesn't in all cases. It strikes me that what you were saying is that as a practical matter, workers' comp is dealt with through this, but it might not necessarily always need to be. And that might affect the resolution of this. And maybe I'm misunderstanding, so just help me out.
If I implied that, I certainly didn't mean to. I think Chapter 102 mandates that any settlement go through the 10229 reimbursement formula.
So always, and just say it this way, the statute says after a final resolution of the underlying cause of action by the injured party against the tortfeasor, That will always, in every case, include a total settlement of all of the workers' compensation issues and the reimbursements that are owed. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay.
Yep. I only have 5 minutes, so I did want to address the argument that they were making about the estate being in a better position than they would have been had the tortfeasor had $250,000 in limits. First of all, there's no statutory or policy language that prohibits an insured from a better recovery because the insured purchased UIM coverage. The statutes prohibit a double recovery. They don't prevent the insured from being made whole. If the insured receives a slightly better recovery than if the tortfeasor had $250,000 because of the unusual facts here, that doesn't violate any statutory or policy language. Instead, it gives the insured the protection he or she paid for. That's what Mr. Huck paid for in this case. He paid for $250,000 in UIM coverage. They're acknowledging that his damages exceed those limits in this case, but want to cap his recovery at $241,000.
If I'm understanding the argument, I think it was advanced because a lot of focus in your briefing and in the Teschendorf decision was on the absurdity of the results. So if we are going to make decisions according to whether the results are reasonable, palatable, unpalatable, then we should be looking at different fact scenarios, shouldn't we? Because some of the arguments seem to suggest that those results would override the plain language. As, again, the court in Teschendorf acknowledged that a plain language reading would result potentially in that case, in the injured person not receiving anything.
If you want to look at the results using the net versus the gross sum, the problem is that Secura's construction will put an injured person in a worse position than if the tortfeasor had the same limits in most cases because of the double offset it's creating from the injured person's recovery.
I actually don't want to look at the results. I'm simply highlighting it as the problematic aspect of the approach the court has taken in the past in Teschendorf, and as I understand the argument that you are advancing. I understand part of your argument is, oh, it's plain meaning, but part of your argument does focus on the results, and that's one of the problems with looking at the results, because then we're interpreting and applying language differently depending on the outcome for the insured, and I don't think that's this court's job. Do you?
I think this court's job is to interpret the statutory or policy language.
And counsel Teschendorf did that in part, didn't it? There was a split on the court. I joined that part that took the focus of the policy, the predetermined amount of recovery, allowing American Family to reduce its uninsured motorist limit by amounts paid by a workers' comp carrier to the fund would deny Scott and his parents a predetermined fixed level of coverage in contravention of the underlying statutory purpose. And it also described the policy. So Teschendorf has a segment on absurd results, but also Justice Prosser wrote something that was not based on any absurd results, but rather the meaning of the text of the statute and looking at the context as a whole, including its purpose, and came up with the holding that I read. Is that correct?
That's correct. I think the court unanimously in Teschendorf looked at the legislative history and the public policy and came together to determine that the legislative intent was that you could only reduce by amounts actually paid to the insured, the insured's heirs, or the insured's estate. Correct. And I see my red light.
It is.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Robinson.
Good morning. May it please the court. Ultimately, this is not an appeal over what the singular term paid means in the context of 632.32.5(i)(2). Rather, this appeal centers on two things. First, what does the entire phrase paid under any workers' compensation law mean? And second, at what point in time are those amounts paid to be computed? As to the first point, to amplify on some points that Mr. Dunn made, Section 102.29 is not some irrelevant small detail. As folks have said, the devil is always in the details. I would refer you to 102.29b2. Here's what the legislature said. Out of the balance of the third-party recovery, the insurance carrier shall be reimbursed for all payments made under this chapter. And so any means all. So the phrase paid under any workers' compensation law in 632.32.5(i)(2) cannot be construed in disregard of 102.29, which modifies the amounts paid to reduce the amounts initially paid by workers' compensation on the front end by the amounts paid back out of a liability settlement. This court has stated that statutes cannot be construed in derogation of common sense. And I'm going to provide an example to help show why Secura's position in this case, it just defies common sense. And if I could pick on two of you in this example. In this example, I am workers' compensation. Attorney Silver is the liability insurer. If I pay you, Justice Rogensack, $36, and Attorney Silver gives you $25, you now have $61. Justice Hagendorn, if I give you $36 and Attorney Silver gives you $25, but you have to pay me back $10, would you consider yourself to have been paid $61? Do you consider yourself to be in the same position as Justice Rogensack, who's sitting there with $61 when you only have $51? Did I really pay you $36 if you had to pay me back $10? Of course not. Common sense does not support their position.
Counsel, you started your comments with, that doesn't mean this case is not about what the definition of paid is, but your example focuses on what does it mean to be paid. So tell me.
The singular term, yes, fair point, Your Honor. The singular term paid in that section, the actual language of the statute is amounts paid under any workers' compensation law. And it's a transaction. To get to Justice Dallet's point about lunch, in any sense of the word paid, the common understanding would be paid means what I am ultimately out at the end of the day when the transaction is complete. 102.29 is a transaction that the legislature has prescribed. Workers' compensation payments are paid on the front end. If there's a third-party liability recovery, the transaction continues. Work comp has the right to get paid back, sometimes fully, sometimes partially, out of that third-party liability claim. And so when we're looking at amounts paid under any workers' compensation law, we have to understand it in that context, after work comp has been partially or fully reimbursed. Now, I want to talk about the second part, timing matters. Justice Hagendorn asked a very important question. I want to make sure we're clear here. 893.43.2 is the statute of limitations for underinsured motorist claims. It specifically references an underinsured motorist claim as defined under Section 632.32.2d. So it's not a freestanding statute. It's specifically referencing back to the underinsured motorist statute, 632.32. And the courts, the legislature there has said that an underinsured motorist claim does not accrue until, quote, the date there is final resolution of the underlying cause of action by the injured party against the tortfeasor. Now, what does that mean? What that means is that an underinsured motorist claim functions in time. And there's a necessary sequencing of events that have to be completed before you can even present an underinsured motorist claim. Now, what do I mean by that? First, workers' compensation makes payments on the front end. Second, the third-party liability claim is resolved for policy limits. Third, by application of 102.29, workers' compensation is paid back. Fourth, importantly, a court or an ALJ, as noted before, has to approve of the distribution of those proceeds under 102.29(1)(d). Why is that? To ensure that the workers' compensation insurer is being paid back, so you don't have the injured worker and or his lawyer forgetting about work comp. And then and only then can the underinsured motorist claim be presented. And the legislative definition of accrual is consistent with what this court has said in Danbeck versus American Family, and more recently Shugarts versus Moore, which is you don't even have the right to make an underinsured motorist claim until the underlying liability limits have been fully exhausted. So as with most things in life, timing matters. Let me give you an example. The lunch example is spot on. Here's another example of why timing matters and why you can't just focus on what was paid out initially rather than at the conclusion of the transaction. Presumably, we all pay taxes. Whether we want to or not is another question, but we all pay taxes. Our employers withhold money from our paychecks and pay it to the government in anticipation of what our taxes are going to be. If we withhold more than we need, we get money back. If we, heaven forbid, under withhold how much we owe for taxes, we have to write a check. How much do we owe in taxes every year is the line item on the tax return that determines what taxes are owed. It's not the amount that was paid in. You can't focus on the initial outlay. You have to focus on when that transaction is completed, what did you actually pay? And in this context, it defies logic and common sense to believe that our legislature would have intended for the amounts paid under workers' compensation to be computed as of the time of the initial outlay of that money by work comp, rather than at the pertinent point in time when you can actually make the claim, which is after work comp's been paid back. Now I want to deal with this issue of putting Huck in a better position. You folks have Secura's brief. They have a chart on page 30 of their brief. Let's just deal with this issue at the beginning. Huck is put in a better position, they say, if we don't get a credit for the gross amount, we only get a credit for the net amount. That's not true. The reason Huck is in a better position is not because of the gross versus net issue. It's entirely because of that $20,000 payment to the supplemental fund, which a unanimous court differing on rationale in Teschendorf said is not properly reduced from UIM limits because that money is going to others, not to the insured. If you take their chart like I have, page 20, what Secura is not telling you in this case and in their briefs is that if you adopt their view that they get a credit for the full amount of the liability limits and the gross amount of work comp payments, that will ensure that the insured will never, ever recover up to the full amount of the purchase UIM benefits. Now, how can I say that? I can demonstrate it to you. Here's their chart. Let's assume Huck had lived and not died. That $20,000 payment on the left column, assuming the tortfeasor had 250 limits, that wouldn't be paid. So he would get a total of $250,000, not $230,000. And what would be the result under Secura's position? Well, voila, he gets $240,000 instead of $250,000. He's shortchanged $10,000. And you and your clerks can do myriad examples, and you'll confirm what I've stated to you. And the reason is obvious, because if a portion of the liability limits is being used to offset what work comp has paid, it's a matter of simple math. The math doesn't work out. They are always, always going to get a double reduction at the expense of their insured, ever recovering up to the full amount of benefits that have been purchased. Secura has offered no plausible explanation here for why our legislature would have intended to allow underinsured motorist insurance companies to get a double reduction.
You talked a lot about intent, as does your colleague on the same side, but we don't look at what the legislature intended, right? We're supposed to be focusing on the language of the policy.
I would agree to the extent that I believe the role of the court, as I understand it, in cases you've set forth, is try to discern the intent of the legislature. Sometimes it can be derived from the plain language of the statute. Sometimes it cannot. So I think I understand your point, and I would agree with that qualification.
It's got to be textually grounded, right? Because otherwise we're just trying to delve into people's minds, and the legislature is not one mind. There's many minds.
No, I agree with that point, and I understand that point. This court delved into the legislative history behind 632.32.5(i)(2). Oh, my time is up. Can I complete my answer?
You may.
In Welland as well as in Teschendorf. And in both cases, when this court looked at the legislative history, they came to the conclusion, it set forth in the LRB file materials, the point of the authorized reductions has to focus on amounts actually received by the insured. And here, Huck did not actually receive $61,000. He actually received approximately $51,000. Thank you.
Thank you. Bottle.
If it may please the court, I would like to reply to some of the arguments raised by opposing counsel in no necessary order. There's the suggestion made that Secura will receive a windfall double benefit if the court adopts the position that Secura advances. That's not true for reasons I've already explained. If there's any windfall or double benefit here, it's to the insured, because as I explained, if the purpose of UIM coverage is to, in effect, provide a level of insurance that would or should have been available to the tortfeasor, but for the tortfeasor's decision not to purchase that, then the recovery would actually have been less. If Mr. Huck or the Huck estate had liability insurance in the amount of $250,000, there is no question that under these facts that they would have recovered less than either the amount paid out under the net benefit analysis or the gross benefit analysis. So in that sense, it cannot be sustained that the insurance company actually receives a windfall. We've talked a bit about the language in the statute and the policy. I have to underscore that the statute and the policy both talk about amounts paid without qualification. It doesn't say who the amount is paid to. And in order to reach the result that opposing counsel is advocating, you would have to read that additional language into the policy and into the statute. Both practices are contrary to what the law requires. We agree that the plain language in the contract and in the statute references payment without reference to the destination of the payment. Our position is that this language is either ambiguous or it is plain, but the result is absurd. Those were the two ultimate positions that were adopted in the Teschendorf decision, and it's our position that the plain language does not produce an absurd result in this case. It produces a result which is fair and that comports to the plain language, and because of that, it's not necessary to go any further. The plain language should be applied, again, without reference to who the payment was made to or anything of that sort.
Do you agree that under your reading, the estate would never be able to get the $250,000 that they contracted for?
I disagree with that, Your Honor, and the reason is simple. If this were not a workplace injury, Section 102 would not even be at issue, and there are a number of hypotheticals on.
If it's a workplace injury.
If it's a workplace injury,
I have... never be able to get their $250,000.
That's possible, but it's not necessary for a policy to be deemed ambiguous just because there's a set of facts under which the ultimate policy limit would not be recoverable. There are always going to be circumstances where that happens.
Counsel, you say it's possible. The only possible scenario that I can envision is if there were workplace injury, but there was no compensation paid. Isn't it true that if there's a workplace injury and compensation is paid, then, finish my sentence.
Yes, then if there's a 102.29 proceeding, the presumption would be that after the first third or the cost of recovery is subtracted and after the insured recovered the first third of the remainder, then thereafter the carrier would be reimbursed to the extent of their worker comp payout.
And then following up Justice Dallet's question, the injured person or the estate here would never receive the predetermined fixed sum of the policy. Is that correct? If compensation were paid for a work-related injury. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I don't want to be impertinent, and I haven't thought through the permutations, but it could depend on any number of things. It could depend on what the arrangement was between the injured worker and the attorney as to the disposition of the costs of recovery.
102.29 requires that formula. It isn't a flexible formula. 102.29, there's a form, for heaven's sakes. That is a worker's compensation.
So, and I don't mean to interrupt. Common sense tells you that there will be some cost of recovery, unless there's something we don't know about the worker and their attorney, and maybe they're the one and the same. But at the end of the day, I will even go so far as to indulge the hypothetical and say there is no circumstance under which there wouldn't be at least some recovery under circumstances where the insured is injured as a result of a workplace accident, makes a worker comp claim, there's a 102.29 recovery. The point is that that does not necessarily mean that the policy is ambiguous, because there are other circumstances under which the policy limit would be available in full or would not be available in its entirety. It's always possible to find hypotheticals and real-world situations that could result in any payment or non-payment across a spectrum of available dollar amounts. I see my time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
All right. The court will meet in closed conference at 11 o'clock.